You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series, celebrating 30 years of OPAR with John Allison, Yaron Brook, and Tara Smith.
We opened the conference with a talk dedicated to OPAR, and I think it's appropriate that in the at a conference where we're celebrating OPAR, we will close the conference with a celebration of OPAR. We're going to have John give some remarks about his experiences with OPAR and the impact OPAR had on him.
Thank you, Yaron, and it's really it's nice to be with you by video. I certainly wish I was there and in person. I unfortunately got a pretty nasty virus, actually dangerous for older people and very contagious for everybody. And my doctor told me I shouldn't go because I would be a hazard for the rest of the crowd along with myself. So I'm sorry I'm not with you in person. It's really a pleasure to talk about OPAR, but I want to do it and kind of provide you a little context. A little background. I was raised in a moderate to low income family. I was the first person in my family that graduated from college. While I was my senior year in college, I was in a bookstore and I stumbled on a book, Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. I started reading the book in the bookstore in the first chapter on what is capitalism by Rand absolutely hooked me. And I went from there. I read Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead. And over the next 10 years, I basically read everything I could find that Rand wrote and people that she was associated with wrote. And it had a profound impact on my life. I was fortunate in having a very successful career. I started out as a farm lender, things like corn and soybeans and hogs and chickens and turkeys. But early in my career, I was asked to create a management development program at BB&T, which is where I was working, because the company was old, but it had no young management. Because of my, love for Atlas Shrugged, I put that book, Atlas Shrugged, in our management leadership program. And so over the last 50 years, basically everybody that's gone into a leadership position has read Atlas Shrugged. They didn't have to agree with the book, but they had to kind of understand it. We gave them a little test at the end to be sure they had read it and they understood it. And I think it's had a profound impact on the performance of the organization. And BB&T, frankly, has done extremely well. I got the good fortune to become CEO in 1989. We were able to put together a young, aggressive leadership team, all who had been influenced by Atlas Shrugged, none of which would call themselves objectivists. We had phenomenal growth. We grew from $4.5 billion in assets to $152 billion in assets over a 20-year period, which is a 20% compound growth rate. Those of you that know anything about mathematics, that's a phenomenal growth rate. We were in the top 10% of any performance measure you wanted to look at in terms of return on assets, return on equity, earnings per share growth. We outperformed the industry, and we were a company that was supposed to be merged away, and we made it. A lot of people got to be very wealthy that never would have expected it. Be wealthy. We were hiring largely people that came off of farms that were going to second tier universities, but they were in the top 10% of the second tier university. And they never expected to make as much money as they did by. We strongly encouraged BB&T stock ownership, and a lot of them became multimillionaires, lots of them. And the reason, in my opinion, that our organization was so successful was because of the ideas and objectives. I think it gave us an enormous competitive advantage in the industry. And we built a lot of those ideas in all of our training programs, all our feedback programs. They were hugely impactful on our organization. In 1992, I think, I stumbled on a thing about OPAR and by Leonard Peikoff, who, you know, I didn't know Leonard, but I had read some of the sections he had and ran related books. And so I ordered OPAR. I expected to read it in, you know, 30 days. I'm a really avid reader, and I typically read at least one serious nonfiction book a month. And I said, well, I'll do this. It took me a year to read OPAR. Because every time I would read something, I'd go back to go and reread it and reread it to be sure I really understood it. And even though I've been studying objectivism for, you know, 20 years, OPAR was an education for me. Because first, it was totally integrated from, you know, the very basics of metaphysics, you know, through art. And that integration was very powerful. And the second thing is it was merciless. Merciless in the sense that I realized that I was rationalizing some things that really didn't fit with the philosophy, but they were kind of painful to change. And OPAR caused me to change them, which I think significantly contributed to the success of BB&T and certainly contributed to my own personal happiness. Because OPAR was so impactful to me, I wanted to meet and thank Leonard. I mean, I ran was no longer alive, so I never got the chance to do that. I said, well, I sure hate not to thank this guy. And I want to support anything he wants to do financially. So I ended up contacting Mike Berliner, who was running ARI, which was a relatively new organization at the time. And Mike was very skeptical initially, but he did some research and found out I was making a whole bunch of money personally at BB&T, far more than I ever expected to make. And so he invited me to a dinner at the equivalent of OCON going back in, you know, I guess this is about 95, 94, 95. 95. And with the board of ARI and with Leonard Peikoff. It was an interesting dinner, frankly, because I was very carefully scrutinized, to say the least. And for some reason, everybody was extremely skeptical that I knew what I was talking about, and I was actually interested in giving them some money. You know, actually, I'd given money to various organizations over the years. Most people didn't get it. They just said thank you. Harry Benslinger was particularly interested. I guess Harry might be in the crowd. He just, you know, he was extremely skeptical. I think he thought I was representing the Communist Party or something. But anyway, Leonard finally spoke up and said, you know, I want to do a radio show. I want a syndicated radio show. I think that's the best way to get out the objectivist message. So I said, great. How much you need? And Leonard and I started, you know, a process, and he actually put together a radio show, and he did very well, and we became friends over the years. He wore him out. It's hard work because Leonard is so much more of a perfectionist than most radio personalities. It was tough work for him, but we became close personal friends, and I have an extraordinarily high regard for Leonard personally. In regards to OPAR, I got a lot of our management team to read it, but I tell you, it's tough reading. If you're not a philosopher, you're not interested in philosophy, it's hard reading. So what I decided to do is I personally wrote a booklet called The BB&T Philosophy, which was a layman's summary of the key values and ethics and virtues in OPAR, in objectivism. And got Leonard to review it and approve it. It became a really critical part of the BB&T culture. Anybody that worked for BB&T had to read the book, would take a test if they, you know, understood the basic ideas presented there. We built it into all of our training programs, and we had a BB&T University. We did lots of training programs. I did quarterly videos and talked about the principles in there. And it really became a powerful tool for us and contributed to that phenomenal success story I just told you about. We couldn't have done it without Rand's ideas in general and the other Objectivist scholars, but also without OPAR, we would not have had that phenomenal success. And I personally owe a very deep debt to Leonard. Not only do I appreciate his friendship, I appreciate his huge intellectual contribution. And of course, I recommend OPAR to anybody that wants to really understand Objectivism. It is a very powerful, thoughtful, merciless in a good sense book. So thank you, Leonard, for a phenomenal contribution and to the success that it led for my organization and for me personally.
Thank you, John. John, can you... I was going to ask you a quick follow-up. Can you say something about the BB&T programs and then your efforts to get some of those people to read OPAR? Because I know of at least one philosopher who seriously read OPAR and I think was I think it contributed to their view of Objectivism.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you brought that up. When I was at BB&T, like all commercial banks, we were making contributions to various charitable organizations, and our focus had been universities. But we started studying where our money was going for universities, and it wasn't really going to support capitalism or free markets or ideas that we thought were important. So we ended up creating 66 centers on the moral foundations of capitalism, which were really devoted to the principal philosophical ideas that underlie free societies, free markets, and the capitalist economic system, and required reading in the leadership lead key course in those programs was Atlas Shrugged. So I don't know exactly what the number was, but we had thousands of students reading Atlas Shrugged in a positive manner, taught by professors who weren't Objectivists necessarily, but thought Atlas was an important book and students ought to read it, and you know, we're fundamentally free market style people. So and most of those programs still survive, and most of them still have a course that requires Atlas Shrugged. So I don't know what the numbers are today, but it's still a fairly large number of those programs still survive. When I was still at BB&T and I was getting the feedback, thousands of those students every year would say, boy, this course was profoundly important. It really changed my worldview. And of course, it wasn't just Atlas, but Atlas was kind of the keystone for the courses. So our challenge, I think, in education is to get people to read Atlas Shrugged, understand the ideas that underline a free society. Yeah. By the way, after I retired from BB&T, I ended up running the Cato Institute, which is a world-leading libertarian think tank. And the first thing I did at Cato, long story, but I'll make it real short. Cato was not doing well. The internal arguments was going on, and Cato was losing a lot of money. So in order to turn Cato around, I talked about what was the BB&T philosophy. I didn't call it that at Cato, but the same basic Objectivist principles. And we were able to turn Cato around. We went from losing a lot of money to making a lot of money. And now Cato is doing extremely well and having a significant impact. At the business school at Wake Forest, we introduced Atlas Shrugged and the ideas that we were using at BB&T. And again, very successful experiences in that regard. I talked to thousands of students every year for years, using basically the BB&T philosophy, the principles that underlie that are in OPAR, and thousands of those students got really fired up and said, "Hey, these ideas I need to pursue them." And I've got a lot of letters over the years saying, Yeah, I went and read Atlas Shrugged, and I heard what you said, and it really changed my worldview. So our challenge is, how do we get to more people?
Great. Thanks, John. Tara?
Okay. I need my notes. So. It's easy to take OPAR for granted because it's been around so long. For some of you, it's always been there, from before you discovered Ayn Rand. Today, we rely on it for a fuller explanation of individual ideas in Rand and of the philosophy as a whole, as a structured body of thought concerning all the philosophic basics. In the before times, though, much more in people's understanding of the philosophy was left to inference. You could read Galt's speech or an essay that Rand wrote on the 72 election or something like that, or her analysis of a papal encyclical, and you could try to piece together whether Rand differed from Aristotle on this aspect of causality or how a moral virtue was properly applied. But OPAR fills in and fleshes out. It exposes the deepest through lines. It's a philosophical elaboration of the entire system of Rand's thought. I think it's hard to fully appreciate what a monumental contribution that is. If you've consumed even a handful of Leonard Peikoff material, you know, be it lectures or essays or parts of OPAR, if you've consumed even a handful, I think you'll agree that its hallmark is clarity. That is his signature. Once you've heard him a few times, if you were lucky enough to do that, hear some of his lectures, whether on tape or live. Once you've heard him a few times, at the opening notes of his voice for a lecture, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, your body would relax with the assurance that the world is about to make a little more sense. Topic after topic, Marx on dialectical materialism, Kant on concepts, the importance of living by principle, socialized medicine, why Johnny can't think. He would part the waters, show the way through the confusing opinions, the seemingly insoluble dilemmas posed by a hard issue. He would so often crack the code of whatever aspect of objectivism you didn't fully understand. I remember still some of the first times I ever heard Dr. Peikoff, and it was on tape. I had heard tapes for a few years before I ever saw him in person, and Anne would play these tapes for me. And I remember in the beginning when I first started to recognize, you know, of a few different speakers who were on tape, I definitely remember that first time that I recognized them. I was like, oh yeah, that guy. He's good, I'm thinking to myself. Now, how does one achieve such clarity as he did, unfailingly? I mean, OPAR, for instance, it opens talking about things like causality, identity, axioms, materialism, real page turners, right? And this guy, he makes you want to be a philosopher, right? You read that first chapter and you're thinking, man, this is where the easy money is. I want a career in philosophy like this. How does he do that? By not settling. Not just saying, ah, it's good enough. Whenever he senses there's something off about that way of putting this, or not quite right, persisting to locate the problem and eliminate it. He would think through every element of possible ambiguity, the possible misinterpretations, the alternative ways of taking a point. He would name those and address them head on. It seems like he continually puts himself in the place of the reader or the listener, if it's a lecture, right? He's objective about the material that he's communicating and how it is likely to be heard, to be taken in by these people, this audience. Now, given the scope of OPAR, encompassing all the branches of philosophy, you might expect precision to be sacrificed. You would be wrong. Peikoff is hyper-precise. He repeatedly offers painstaking dissection of issues. For instance, the meticulous dismantling of the arbitrary across about 8 pages of his chapter on reason. Another of his characteristic tools, luminous examples. And good examples do not spring to mind readily. I mean, let me tell you, I know when I'm writing, I always, you know, need examples there. I'll throw down one or two, but I constantly have notes to myself, and it really takes hard work to come up with good examples. I don't even, you know, I don't feel like I always come up with the best examples. But Peikoffs, so often absolutely perfect. They devastate the opposing view, illustrate all they were intended to, and leave no remainder of little questions or hesitations in your mind. He makes it all seem self-evident, blazingly obvious. You wonder, like, how could I have ever questioned this? Consider also his often vivid telling encapsulations of a position or a point. Just a few from Opar. You know, concept, fallacy of the stolen concept? He describes the concept stealer as an epistemological parasite. Agnosticism represents the enshrinement of ignorance. I love that one. It's the enshrinement of ignorance. The romanticist is intoxicated with the possible. Let me dig a little deeper, though, on the core of Opar's value. Opar presents systematically Ayn Rand's entire philosophy, its essentials in all the major branches. It's not a mere digest, though. It's systematic in presenting them in logical, layered structure, explaining how they are related to one another and how they relate to traditional debates in philosophy, to alternative ways of thinking about issues, different conclusions. Now, bear in mind, Ayn Rand was a fiction writer. That was her love, her first love. Now, in nonfiction, she gave us numerous essays and lectures on issues of the day, a given Supreme Court ruling, a foreign policy venture, and on the zeitgeist, right, the, you know, Woodstock, the ecology movement, space exploration. She also wrote, in nonfiction, an introduction to objectivist epistemology, which is intended as merely an introduction. And I quote her on this, she said, "I entitled this work an introduction because the theory is presented outside its full context. For instance, I do not include here a discussion of the validity of man's senses," close quote. Opar does provide the full context. Chapter 2 is devoted entirely to sense perception and volition to set up the account of concept formation, which gets chapter 2, and then the objectivity of concepts and of all knowledge gets its own chapter 4. And epistemology hardly ends there. Much later in Opar, in the chapter on capitalism, we learn how opposition to capitalism is based on bad epistemology. Rand's writing, as I think probably all of you realize, I mean, her writing in the 60s and 70s on topical issues offered penetrating insights that stand the test of time because they are rooted in philosophical fundamentals. You read her analyses of these issues today, 60 years later, and they illuminate what we confront. Opar identifies those fundamentals, finds the blood vessels animating all of her analyses. Opar completes the presentation of objectivism, showing it as a single integrated system, consistent with reality, consistent internally. Drawing on his years of study with Ayn Rand and his years of living, just, you know, what you observe in life when you take those elevator, those causation walks, as Greg was referring to them all earlier and so on, right? Drawing on all of this, Opar made the philosophy objective. Now, not in the sense of providing it with validity. That was in the philosophy itself. That preceded Leonard Peikoff. But actually, put an asterisk on that. We're going to come back to that. But in laying it out for others' study, others' inspection. That's the sense in which I think Opar really completes the presentation of objectivism. And it doesn't simply weave together what Rand said in public venues. This isn't the work of a good scribe. Opar is also informed by the behind-the-scenes discussions. We get Peikoff's identification of the crucial elements and how they are related to one another. Do you have to, or let's, Do you have to understand volition before epistemology, for instance? He's figuring that out in terms of figuring out how to present things in the most logical and understandable manner, right? How can value be objective without being intrinsic? How does epistemology bear on the nature of government? These are the sorts of things he's grappling with. Opar provides the benefit of countless hours of discussion that he had over 30 years with Ayn Rand. He asked questions that pushed her to elaborate more fully on many issues. She had his ear, and he listened. And he posed further questions to make sure he was getting exactly what she said. He had her ear, so he raised his confusions, dilemmas, objections he was hearing in grad school, you know, but what about blah, blah, blah. Right? If he hadn't written Opar, it would have been good to have notes from all those conversations, recordings, transcripts, something like that, right? But he instigated a lot of those conversations, pushed them into deeper regions, and then did the work of integrating and presenting them for readers in stunningly lucid terms. That is an achievement. And let's pause on how difficult what he achieved in Opar was and how admirable, on at least three levels. First, his persistence in asking questions of Ayn Rand. A little intimidating, don't you think? I mean, you know, you get scared getting up here on the line to ask questions of, you know, you and me, right? I mean, I get scared. You don't see me on those lines too much, right? You know, and here he is. And, you know, she was not known as the coddling type, right? When it came to ideas, she wasn't going to go along and smile like a nice Russian grandmother doting on everything he said because, you know, he likes her, right? He'll report sometimes raising questions that would make her angry because it'd be, oh my God, you still don't understand, right? Okay. He persisted. Whatever the question, he wanted to get it right. He didn't retreat. Those conversations with him at the elevator and her with the foot in the door, and he'd say, well, one more thing, right? And then they'd go on for another hour in the middle of the night. I'm glad they had those conversations. We are all the beneficiaries. But there's more. And I'm still just talking about his persistence, okay? When it comes to writing Opar, he's seeking to record the whole of her philosophy in a clear, accessible way for the ages. No pressure. He knew what the project meant, what place this book should have. And he took forever to write it. Or at least when we were waiting for it, that's how it seemed. Now the fact that he wrote it in like, I don't know, 9-ish years, I have to say it seems like that doesn't seem long at all because it takes me forever to write anything. But I mean, why did it take him long? Or why would he think it's going to be this year and then say, no, it's going to be another year? Because he had to get it right, right? And he would completely redo and rethink whole chapters and sections, right? Opar is the product of a person who cares, who takes ideas dead seriously, and who gets what the philosophy means. Opar gives perfectionism a good name. A second aspect of the achievement, I think the sheer intelligence involved. His facility, his nimbleness with the highest abstractions, his command over the broadest principles and the smallest applications. To appreciate this, just a little context from my own experience. When I was in grad school, my dissertation was on individual rights, the inflation of rights, and I had a great basis in Ayn Rand's essay, Man's Rights, and her essay, The Nature of Government. And those were pretty much my sort of go-to sources that I was drawing from to write about rights. Then, much more recently, several years ago, when I turned to do something in philosophy of law, I realized, gee, there's nothing comparable that Rand wrote about law per se. She had said many things about the law, but very scattered across, you know, some analyses of a Supreme Court opinion or, you know, writings on antitrust or intellectual property, something like that. But there was no essay directly on objective law, right? Well, that made it a lot harder, what I was then doing. But it was a breeze, comparatively. Because she, I mean, it was still very easy in a lot of ways because she had, you know, laid out the political philosophy, which is the foundation for the legal philosophy and so on. So whereas I still had the framing of the political philosophy, think of Opar. No such framing, right? He's figuring out what is the framework, how to put it all together. The whole philosophy isn't delimited in the way that philosophy of law is, one region, right? He had to explain her framework itself. A is A, consciousness, all the way through, you know, what's wrong with egalitarianism or non-objective art. And the third aspect of the achievement gets us back to that asterisk I referred to a few minutes ago. I had said, I think Opar made the philosophy objective. The validity of the philosophy preceded Leonard Peikoff, okay, but what I do want to add here is this. Yes, made the philosophy objective in this sense, or beyond what I said a little bit earlier. I do think, sorry, let me put this more clearly. There's a sense in which, look, objectivism didn't need Leonard Peikoff to be valid. But I think Opar does deepen the validation of objectivism by demonstrating how integrated the philosophy is, how tightly woven its individual strands. I think in doing that, it's strengthening it. I mean, remember, a crucial part of how you validate anything, according to the objectivist epistemology, according to reality, right? A crucial part of how you validate a claim is by means of integrating it with other things that we know. Yeah. In Opar, by integrating a claim about volition or the mind-body relationship or independence with our knowledge of self-esteem or force or sex, by doing these things, Peikoff is solidifying the validation of Ayn Rand's philosophy. He's adding more nails to the coffins of the opposing views. Okay, so some closing thoughts. Much as I've tried, much as I've tried to convey some of its tremendous value for all of us, there's definitely still a sense in which I know I don't get Opar. I know that I don't fully understand its achievement. Partially this is a matter of intelligence, partially it's a matter of knowledge. I don't have the conceptual facility, and I'm not trying to be modest here or anything. I know a lot of what I know and some of what I don't know. I don't have the conceptual facility, the really secure, grounded, solid agility with the most encompassing abstractions and integrations that he does. I mean, by a long shot, right? It's also a matter of knowledge. I'd be better positioned to assess Opar's contribution if I had an independent command of objectivism, right? But so much of my understanding of objectivism is through Opar, is thanks to Opar, right? I mean, if you were Ayn Rand, you could give good assessment of how good is Opar, right? Or there are even other people, though, I think, better positioned than I, someone like a Harry Binswanger or the late Alan Gotthelf, people who were there before Opar, but with Ayn Rand and in on all of those discussions and understood the philosophy as the best minds at the time. I mean, I think in certain, definite ways, they're in a better position. I will, though, finish just by saying a few things at a more personal level. I started out by saying I think it's easy to take Opar for granted because it's been around 30 years. And I think the same is true of Leonard. And I'm sorry, he is Leonard for me, so I will refer to, or I have referred to him sometimes in that way. You know, you can think of Leonard Peikoff as Moses, or one of these larger-than-life figures, especially if you've never met him, from the land of the giants, something like that. Leonard Peikoff is a boy who grew up in Winnipeg. And at some point he read Ayn Rand and he thought, whew, yeesh, I've got to ask this woman some questions. And he did, and you know, over the years, and then he went to meet her and he went to talk with her some more, you know, and it became to the point of I have to write this book and so on. If your life is better for it, I hope you don't mind my suggesting, you ought to let him know. Drop him a line. I think you could use the public email address leonard@peikoff.com. You know, it would get to him. Now, he doesn't need us to tell him how good Opar is. But if you know, if your life is the better for it, and not everybody has read or experienced all that much Opar at this stage, right? But if your life is significantly the better for it, then I think, you know, he may not need it, but he deserves it. And I'll just say for myself, I mean, for the longest time, I thought, my God, Ayn Rand gave me my life. I mean, her ideas, what that woman understood and then explained and showed in her work, I mean, she gave me my life. But I would not have gotten nearly all I've gotten out of it had it not been for the illuminations of Leonard Peikoff. So thank you, Leonard. Thank you.
Thank you, Tara. So I've already spoken on Opar. So I thought I'd spend just a few minutes, and then we'll take your questions. We'll leave some time for that. Just a few minutes about Leonard's other work, if you will, and particularly Leonard Peikoff as teacher, and how much we've learned from him. Not just through the books he's written, but through all the courses, if you think about all the courses that we have all experienced, some of us live, and I think that's always been incredibly enjoyable, and I agree with Tara about the effect that his voice would have on one when he started speaking. But think of all the work that Leonard has done over many decades, even before Opar, telling us about what was coming in Opar, articulating and starting to create that integration in our minds of what Opar would be. As I said in my talk, my first exposure to Leonard Peikoff was 1987 when he was doing Objectivism, a State of the Art. On the shuttle bus to that conference, I met Tara and Anne. So it was quite a conference, and it was quite an experience. But just that course, you know, that experience, I learned so much. I one of the things I learned was how much I didn't know, because I'd been grappling with Objectivism for 10 years, in a sense alone, with other people, again, at about the same level as I, and learning, you know, seeing the master teach us about Objectivism was truly, in a sense, a revelation in terms of how rich the material was and how much more there was to learn. But then it's subsequent conferences, conference after conference, and you can get all this material today for free online. The history of philosophy, how many of us know the history of philosophy? Because we listened to Leonard Peikoff's tapes, or at least that was our introduction to the history of philosophy. Some of us went on to read other books maybe, but that was the intro. That's how we've learned most of our categories about the different philosophers and the different eras in philosophy, how philosophy impacts history, whether it's the Ominous Parallels or the Epilogue, which is a wonderful chapter at the end of Opar, but the relationship between philosophy and history. How to appreciate aesthetics. So we've got a chapter on aesthetics in Opar, and of course we've got the Romantic Manifesto, but then in a sense applied in his eight great plays, one of my all-time favorites that I also got to see live in 1993, I think it was. And of course, how to really not really replicate, because there's no way to replicate, but how to appreciate the achievement, Ayn Rand's achievement in Objectivism, and how she induced the philosophy. Right? And that was his course on philosophy through induction, which he did in the late 1990s, all leading up to his courses on induction, on the problem of induction, and ultimately on his book on the dim hypothesis. But the arc of the whole thing, the extent of the values that we have all gotten from Leonard Peikoff, is just astounding. in terms of the scope, the intensity, the clarity, often the beauty of everything we have gained from him. So, you know, and then some of us, of course, I think many of the generation that has been speaking here were students of Leonard's to some degree or another, who learned from him directly, whether it's the confusion papers that we wrote, and were told that we were a lot more confused than we thought we were, and that all our confusions stemmed from epistemological problems that we had and that we did have. And part of how we grew up intellectually is by dealing and solving the issues that he identified. Where there were some of us who took speaking classes from him. He had a little seminar, a seminar where we went and Leonard Peikoff sat on his sofa and we would make a little presentation, talk about nerve-wracking, right? And he would critique it if he'd let you get through more than a couple of sentences. So we learned so much, and so much of the value you're receiving from many of the speakers is a consequence of the learning from him. And of course, today, as I mentioned in my talk, OPAR, since the beginning, and continues to be a source, the main text for all of our programs, OAC programs, our OGC programs, the programs in which we teach the next generation of intellectuals. So OPAR will be with us for a very long time. Its impact on objectivism will be there forever, and its impact on generation after generation of intellectual will be there forever. So again, thank you, Leonard Peikoff, for many, many, there'll be many, many more generations that will be thankful for the work that he has done. And I encourage you, those of you who are new and who didn't experience Leonard live, go to the courses all online now. Start listening to the Leonard Peikoff body of work. I think you'll benefit your understanding of objectivism, and your enjoyment from objectivism. The value that you will get from objectivism will be enhanced dramatically. All right, thank you, and we will take questions. So.
Thank you all. Do you have any recommendations, any strategies for getting the most out of studying OPAR?
I mean, I do think getting small groups of people together is really valuable, to talk about what you don't get. Because it's hard, and again, from the very beginning, we're talking about causation, fairly dusty abstract issues, especially for most people. So I do think it's really valuable, whether it be you happen to know one or two people who you think are pretty good minds and good objectivists, or whether it's six or seven. But really taking your time with it, not so much time that, I mean, there are pluses and minuses, but I do think you really want to let yourselves grapple as honestly as you can with trying to make sense of it in your own terms. Nothing else specific comes to mind right away.
John, feel free to jump in, because you're not here, so I can't actually get any.
my experience is you just have to gut it out. You have to keep coming back and saying, does that make any sense? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I agree with that. Take your time with it. Keep going back to it. But I mentioned in my talk, I think study groups are a real value here, because somebody will ask a question that will stimulate a question in your mind. You might have not thought that something was unclear, or you didn't see a connection between two things. So having multiple minds kind of approaching this and challenging each other in a sense with questions and grappling with the content is really, really helpful. And so many of us, I think, if I speak for many people in the audience, went through OPAR in that way years and years ago when it first came out. And first of all, you meet people, and so it's a nice way to kind of engage with people. But more importantly, it's a great way to really learn and really study it. And it also gets you into the habit of, oh, you meet once a week or you meet twice a week, so you're reading, you're preparing, you're thinking about what's being challenging here, and you get to experience other minds grappling with the same issues.
One other specific that can sometimes be helpful is give everybody a question quota. That is, like, say something like, for each section, everybody's got to try to come up with three questions for our next meeting or something. Now, it's not that you have to actually at the meeting hear every participant's all three questions, but I think sometimes people are shy about asking questions, or they're afraid my question's going to sound so stupid and everybody else knows the answer to this. But if you can't, part of the job of, okay, we're reading this section or this chapter for next week or next meeting, everybody's got to come up with X number of questions such that, you know, if you're called on, you could give us one or two. It just gets people in that more active engagement mode, you know. And, I mean, I think this is obvious from some of what we've said, but the rereading of OPAR is good. If you've read it, read it again, if you haven't read it in a while. Because you get more out of it as your own life experience changes and so on. You get different questions out of it. It's rich, like having read it several times. It's rich. I just reread it in the last year. Hey, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Hi. I wonder if you have a particular problem or issue that you recall grappling with and having resolved by reading OPAR.
In all honesty, no. I mean, I can't say there was one on my mind like, oh, and then this, but on a number of things, it makes this so much clearer. I think my experience was often more the, I thought I understood that.
Yeah.
I didn't have a puzzle. I didn't have a question. You know, I thought I got that. Ooh, and then you read the, like, ah, now I see this other aspect of it. I think I had a lot of that experience with OPAR.
I had one very important experience. I had thought I'd left religion behind. I was raised in a very religious family. My dad was an amateur preacher. I was right, and actually, when I read Atlas Shrugged, I let go of religion, and as best I could. It takes a while to let go of something that profound. But what I discovered when I started reading OPAR, is I hadn't really let go of it at a subconscious level. It was still there, haunting me, and probably influencing some of my decisions where. Where I really should have been dealing with an individual, say, that had a performance problem. But I wanted to be merciful, i.e., in a religious sense of the word, so I kind of tolerated them way past when I should have. And reading OPAR was a wake-up call to say, A, that's religious background, and B, it's actually not fair to the person, certainly not fair to the organization. If they're going to be a performance issue, you might give them some warning, but you need to go and deal with it fast enough. So I discovered a couple things like that were important that I really had kind of hidden from myself because at some level I really didn't want to deal with them.
Yeah, I mean, very similar to Tara. There's nothing I can remember as being the issue, although I'm sure they were. But then my memory's not that great, never has been. But the clarity, and many, 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 many times, and still, when I go back to OPAR, it's still true. I'll read something and I say, I thought I knew this, and I don't really. Mm. So, and I still, you know, and some sections are still a little fuzzy in my, you know, if I had it, because I just finished reading it recently. But yes, it's that. I thought I understood this topic, and now I realize, whoa, there's so much more here. And by the way, I get that from almost any one of Ayn Rand's essays. You read it, and you think, oh, I've read this before. I know this stuff. And then, you know, try reading What is Capitalism, or I always use that as an example, because I talk about capitalism a lot. And yet, right, and so you think I'd really know it. And then every time I read What is Capitalism by Ayn Rand, I discover something new in it. It's such a deep essay. There's so much interesting stuff there. And it's non-obvious that there's something to be learned every time. And I think that's definitely the case with OPAR in any one of the chapters.
Thank you.
Here's an online question. Years ago, when I couldn't get through the initial chapters, even after a few attempts of reading Opar, I tried reading the chapters backwards. That is, starting from Art and Happiness, going to Epistemology and Metaphysics. Do you recommend that?
No, I wouldn't recommend it. I mean, look, and Lennon Peikoff says this many times, it's an integrated whole. There's a hierarchy, but you could start anywhere and get anywhere. But Opar is written in a particular way. Every chapter is built on the next chapter. Every chapter hooks backwards to the previous material. It really is, he builds it hierarchically. I mean, it's there. You could read it the other way around, but I don't think that as a first reading that makes any sense, because there's certain concepts that he's discussing, certain things he's already addressed that he's taken, that he assumes you know, in the chapter on aesthetics, certainly on the chapter on capitalism, where he's referring back to issues in ethics or to issue in epistemology, which you haven't got to because you're reading the book backwards. So no, read it the way it was supposed to be read, the way it was written.
Particularly if you're reading it to understand the philosophy. Now, maybe you're not. You're not that interested in understanding objectivism, but I'm interested in happiness. What did he have to say about what Rand had to say about happiness or some particular topic, capitalism or whatever? Okay, then just read that chapter or what's relevant. But if you want to understand it to understand objectivism, then for the reasons that Yaron just mentioned, start at page one and
today I use it as a reference book to some.
Oh yeah, you look up a particular thing.
So you look up a particular thing. You look up a particular virtue
or
something in epistemology. Or what I want to remember exactly what Leonard Peikoff said about the arbitrary, right? So you just read that section of the book. But no, I mean it's you want to get the complete. Yes, Gloria.
Thank you so much for the panel. My question is, I think that one of the applied principles of Opar in a course is objective communication of Leonard Peikoff. And I'm thinking of non-English speaking audiences who already have access to Opar in Spanish, let's say. But if there would be the possibility of making that course in the native language of people that are interested in communicating better, how to replicate the genius of Peikoff in teaching that course in a different language, considering that it is an absolute reflection of his organized thinking in Opar.
So you don't think subtitles would do it?
I don't know. I mean, sometimes communicating in your native language makes neurological connections that are different, and people get better sometimes things in their native language. Maybe they won't. It's too late for them to learn English. I don't know.
We need a Leonard Peikoff who speaks Spanish.
Yeah, no good thoughts there.
Thank you.
I don't actually have a question on Opar, other than to say Atlas Shrugged changed my life, and what Leonard Peikoff did absolutely enriched my life to a huge extent, and I'm really thankful for what he did. But I did want to ask John Allison a question about why there aren't more of him in the business world. I mean, I would like what you did. I was at Lehman Brothers in 2008, not knowing if I had a job on September 16th. But then in the weeks and months following that, it was like one person like John Allison who's there, who's able to say, look, I've been through this, I've done this, and there's a better way. This is not, greed was not invented in 2008. And I was like, thank you. But why is it one of you?
Any twins
well,
there,
first,
John?
Thank you for the compliment. I appreciate that. I guess I'm not alone, and there are a few other people that fit that category. For example, one of my friends is Dick Kovacevic, that ran Wells Fargo for a long period of time. But there are not many. First, business people tend to be very pragmatic. And, you know, and objectivism is pragmatic in the sense that it works in the real world, but you can't really get it from a pragmatic worldview, you have to be interested intellectually and I call it spiritually in an integrated worldview. And a lot of business people don't think that way, unfortunately. And I think it makes them far less successful in their organizations. It's less successful than they could be. And I was discouraged. I went to a lot of banking meetings and industry meetings, and they were always trying to figure out how to get the government to help, how to get it, leave them alone or give it to help them, instead of trying to figure out how to run their business right, which actually gave us a huge competitive advantage because we weren't much into that. We were just trying to run our business well and create superior value for our customers, and in that process, it creates superior value for our shareholders. So, and of course, unfortunately, since the financial crisis, a huge percentage of the CEOs are in that position for political reasons in large companies. The government got so involved in the management of large financial institutions that the only people that could survive were people that, could make government bureaucrats happy, which was tragic. I think it's hurt the actual growth rate and the impact of the industry. So I do find it a huge frustration that there aren't more philosophical objectivists, CEOs, but they are rare. I do think it's an irony, given what a huge competitive advantage objectivism could be.
Yeah. That's sad. Thank you, John. Thank you. So this is the last event of the conference. We do have a reception and dinner tonight, so I hope all of you are going to be there. But this is my opportunity to thank you all for coming. Thank you all, those of you who support the Ayn Rand Institute, thank you for supporting the Institute. I think the one hope we have for having many more CEOs who have integrated objectivism like John and integrated in their business, and hopefully we are training that generation right now as we speak, and you will see the consequence of that in the years to come. So thank you for those of you who support those efforts and continue. We are the place where you study objectivism. We have the teachers, we have the books, we have now the resources to make it happen.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.